And there's no better indication of the fact that Fox is a propaganda machine and not a real news organization than the fact that they're willing to undercut their own reporting to serve the president's agenda. No legitimate news organization would do that. When the New York Times reports something negative about Joe Biden, they don't use the headline, "Failing New York Times spreads fake news." Sad. Just goes to show you, they can't actually campaign on their record, so instead they're trying to concoct an alternate universe where coronavirus is over, the economy is back, and a president who brags about arms sales is anti-war. If that doesn't work, Trump will probably just try to convince people that he's Joe Biden.
You know, I was just saying to my wife, Jill, no more malarkey. We hate malarkey, don't we, folks? We've had it up to here with the malarkey.
I think it's safe to say, at this point, that instead of hiring the best and the brightest, the GOP and the Trump campaign are filled with
the worst, the weakest, and the slowest.
This is an important message for all my strong MAGA supporters. I'm not doing it through the fake news tonight. I need to talk directly to our great patriots. As you know, we are under attack. We're under vicious and nasty attack from the left. Law and order is collapsing, and they are using a very special, very nasty new weapon called soup. You know, we used to have a thing called soup kitchens. Not a lot of people know this, but it would be where the people who didn't have food, you know, kind of not hardworking people, they'd go and get the free soup, and you'd keep it in a big, like a big bucket, a bowl, pot, a big pot. And, you know, you'd dip the spoon, the big spoon, the big, Mike, what's it called, the ladle. The ladle? That's a funny word. You'd dip it in the ladle, and you'd pour it out. But nobody could take the soup with them. It was safe in the big pots. And now, recently, probably under Obama, they invented something called soup cans. And don't get me started on bags of soup. They swing a bag of soup, you're a goner. That's one of the nastiest ways to go. But now they have cans of soup. And Mike, I know you said you hate cans, right? When mother walks in a tight shirt, you tell her you hate the cans. Not a fan of cans, Mike. He knew right away. But they're using soup as a weapon against us, and we're defenseless. All we have are assault weapons and, you know, insanity on our side. They have unlimited soup, unlimited quantities of soup. And they come in three varieties, and you got to look out for all of them. Campbell soup, which is kind of the poor people's soup, and the cans are kind of little. They can still hurt, but you got to be careful. And then Progresso, okay? We know what that sounds like, progressive. It's a nasty liberal soup. You get hit with one of those, it's like getting hit by the whole squad with their socialism. And last, watch out for chunky soup. Used and endorsed by many African-American NFL players with the big chunks. Very tough. So get your weapons.
And then they have cans of soup. Soup.
You think you can get soup?
This is soup for my family. We have people coming over with bags of soup, big bags of soup.
Please, you're wasting everyone's time.
Oh, this is soup for my family. It's the perfect size. It's like made perfect.
You're pushing your luck, little man.
But a can of soup, you can really put some power into that, right?
Very good. Very good. You know something? No soup for you!
The White House rushes to respond to yet another damaging and explosive story about the president's comments made in private. This time, audio tapes revealing President Trump understood the true danger of the coronavirus in early February, all while playing it down to the American public for weeks and months after that. Now, in a series of interviews with veteran Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward for his new book, Rage, Trump admits that the virus is deadly and highly contagious.
So what was President Xi saying yesterday?
Well, we were talking mostly about the virus, and I think he's going to have it in good shape, but, you know, it's a very tricky situation.
It goes
through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air. That's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus. This is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff.
All right, so just weeks later, Trump publicly doubted the exact same threat he'd just acknowledged to Woodward there in private.
Flu has a fatality ratio of about 0.1%.
Correct.
This has a fatality ratio somewhere between 2 and 3%.
Well, we think. We don't know exactly what. And the flu is higher than that. The flu is much higher than that.
All right, so later in March, the president then explained to Woodward why he felt the need to dismiss the danger in public.
I think, Bob, really, to be honest with you.
Sure, I want you to.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
Now, while Trump was saying that to Woodward, he was telling the public this.
I don't think they're panicking. I don't think people are panicking. I said last night we did an interview on Fox last night, a town hall. I think it was very good. And I said, calm. You have to be calm. It'll go away.
Here's where we are at this hour. 6 months later, the United States has nearly 6.4 million cases and more than 191,000 deaths and still climbing.
As early as January 28th, the president was told by his national security advisor and his deputy national security advisor that this was a deadly virus, that it was coming from China, and that it was airborne.
Yeah, and it's obvious, you know, you asked the question, as they did during Nixon, what did the president know and when did he know it? And he clearly knew in January that this was going to be a major potential catastrophe for the country as well as the world. And rather than step up and take control the way a great leader like Winston Churchill would do or Franklin Roosevelt, he decided to play ostrich and bury his head and the American public in the sand and pretend that this huge threat didn't exist.
Vote once, twice. I would go and follow it and go vote.
At an airport rally in North Carolina Wednesday, President Trump told his supporters that if they vote by mail, they should also then go vote in person.
And then if they tabulate it very late, which they shouldn't be doing, they'll see you voted and so it won't count. So send it in early and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote and the vote is going to count. You can't let them take your vote away.
In some states, you can ask for your mail-in ballot to be invalidated, but intentionally voting twice is fraud and a felony in most states and could lead to chaos at precincts on Election Day.
A friend of mine said, you have to be the most innocent, honorable man ever to hold the office of president. Think of it.
One friend said to me, you have to be the most innocent man in the history of the United States.
Friends of mine have said, sophisticated friends have said, you've got to be the most innocent guy ever to hold this office. And there's a lot of truth to that.
A friend of mine said, you have to be the most perfect person.
They had everybody up to.
I think I did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends. It might seem like a crush, but that doesn't mean that I'm serious. But to lose all my senses. It's just so typically me. Ooh, baby, baby, oops, I-
Oops, I did it again. I played with your heart, got lost in the game. Ooh, baby, baby, oops.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
Good day, all. Today we're going to be hearing from Miriam Axel Lew, editor of Shelter Force magazine and a regular writer and analyst of housing justice and community development issues for over two decades. We'll be hearing Miriam, who spoke during a webinar recorded on July 1st, 2020, in partnership with the nonprofit Quarterly Organization. The topic of the webinar was housing justice amid COVID-19.
My name is Miriam Axelud. I'm the editor of Shelter Force magazine. We're a national publication, as Steve mentioned, that covers affordable housing, community development, housing justice, healthy neighborhoods. And we write for people who are working in those areas or whose work intersects with those topics in some way, even if they don't see themselves as housers first and foremost. But our core readers are often community-based nonprofit leaders. You know, everybody's worried right now about what's going to happen when eviction moratoriums lift. Many places put various eviction moratoriums of various strengths in place to try to make sure people could shelter in place. But many of those have just lifted, are starting to lift, are about to lift. And the people who lost their jobs, most of them have not gone back to work. Unemployment supplements are about to wind down. Those who are back at work did not necessarily get back pay. So there is this massive wave of evictions that is pending unless something more is done. And it should be pretty obvious what a catastrophe that would be. Now, there's a range of responses that we could make to that. There's a lot of people who are working on standing up court defenses and mitigation programs, negotiation and other things. But the thing that would actually prevent that wave of evictions is either, it falls into two broad camps, sort of rent relief or rent cancellation. And many of you have heard the term cancel rent, about the cancel rent movement. Which is one of those. So rent relief, and there's a large, in the HEROES Act contained and the bill that Elizabeth Warren just put out, both contain pieces of this, would be targeted payments to those who need help to pay their rent. Rent cancellation would say the rent does not need to be paid, and then figure out how to address relief to owners as needed through mortgage cancellation or other means. And there's some tension between these. They both have the same goals. There are some pros and cons to both approaches. Some of the pros to rent cancellation is that it would include everybody who needs it, including the most vulnerable renters. Rent would not need to be paid, and it would be instant. Whereas if you have to be eligible for government help, you're going to start losing people who are undocumented workers, people who are in the informal economy, people who were already out of work when the pandemic hit, and so on, and people who have difficulty pulling together the documentation. And we're already hearing in New York City, for example, that landlords are on the move trying to get personal financial information out of their tenants to see who they're allowed to evict now that there's a measurement about whether you were affected by COVID or not. So rent cancellation is unequivocal housing stability for renters. And then the paperwork and the targeting and the processing and the figuring out how to get relief out would fall on the owners. And it may actually be better for them as compared to evicting a tenant and losing back rent. Now, there are some cancel rent proponents who are, in fact, organizing with small landlords under a broad no new debt mantra, where they're calling for mortgage cancellation and rent cancellation at the same time, with an understanding that their interests are connected. You know, there are cons as well, or dangers. So it's obviously, if you cancel rent for everybody, including those who are currently able to pay, you're bringing a larger disruption to the housing system. There's possible added disruption to small landlords, nonprofit housing providers. Rent doesn't just pay for mortgages and profit. It covers a wide range of costs that keep housing operating: taxes, insurance, utilities, repairs. So there's a fear that if you do that, particularly without sufficient support to housing providers, it would increase the ability of private equity to come in and scoop up more small rental properties, which further destabilizes the housing system in the long run. We saw a bunch of that in the 2008 financial crisis, and nobody wants that to happen again. And of course, reimbursing owners for all rent payments would be extremely costly, as opposed to targeting the resources more. You know, Urban Institute recently estimated that when unemployment assistance expires, it's going to take $15.5 billion a month to alleviate cost burden for renters who were cost burdened before the pandemic and for renters who lost their jobs as a result of it. And that's even just with that targeting, though it's a fairly broad targeting. And I think some of the key questions are, can we find a way to address the questions and the concerns that are raised by both of these approaches? Can we make a rent relief program that reaches everyone in need, or figure out another way to get to all of those most vulnerable renters? Can we cancel rent in a more targeted way, or a way that really protects the small landlords and housing providers that we don't want to lose? In either case, are we prepared to capture the rental properties that are going to be sold or whose owners are going to walk away, which is going to happen under either scenario, and bring them into some kind of permanently affordable housing? And I think an important question is, can we find a way to come together across these philosophies and make sure that something, and to Amina's note, something big enough does happen?
Great. Thanks, Miriam. That's really helpful. I thought I'd just ask about one wrinkle on this. So I've seen ideas of extending mortgages. So in other words, if the payments for the landlord were suspended for 6 months, then their mortgage would be extended on the back end for those six months. Is that part of the conversation still?
Absolutely. That's the approach to forbearance that's going to work, right? I mean, having a mortgage forbearance for a couple of months and then having it all come due is very similar to having an eviction moratorium and then having it lift. That doesn't do anything but have that temporary pressure on the wound. So we do need to have these transferred into what will be a modification. It has to be a modification to add those payments on the end of the mortgage to really have that help be sustainable.
Next, Steve Dubb, senior editor at NPQ and the moderator for the webinar, speaks with Andromeka Morris, executive director for Housing NOLA, a 10-year partnership between community leaders and dozens of public, private, and nonprofit groups implementing a strategic plan designed to reduce housing insecurity in New Orleans. Andromeka continues the conversation on what can possibly happen when the rent moratoriums end and the mortgage forbearance programs end.
Andronika, anything you want to say about what do you see as the appropriate policy response in this period?
So I agree with Miriam that we have to first and foremost decide that we're going to do something about this. We haven't made that decision yet. And that's a part of the problem. And again, this is pre-COVID. This is the deep structural bias around affordable housing, because no one talks about this. And those of us who do the work, certainly we've got allies on this issue, but I'm talking about as a movement, there is no real commitment to this in the hearts and minds of our policymakers and our elected officials. And that decision that's got to be the first decision, that we decide to do this, and that will guide how this works. We're concerned about making sure that people who are using landlord property or rental property as income are also not left out in the cold. But we also want to make sure that there are not these unreasonable barriers, because right now health is connected to housing. As we see surges in the COVID pandemic, if we do not have another shelter at home order, which seems unlikely throughout the lifetime, it may not happen in the next few months. All estimates tell us is that before a vaccine, we will probably have another wave. that will require everyone to shelter at home. We need to make sure that everyone actually has a home that they can do that in. And that means be you formerly incarcerated, be you currently incarcerated, homeless, housing insecure, doubled up with family, or, you know, working a job that doesn't allow you to make ends meet. All of those folks need to have assurances that they will actually be able to be safe. And that's got to be key to this commitment. And as we come out of this, then we've got to start talking about the long-term solution so that this never happens again.
And that concludes a portion of a webinar on housing justice amid COVID-19. And this is Michelle Masurjian for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Thank you. kiss my groom, keep the glow, feel the spoon, melt the snow, lick the spoon, grip the light, suck the flavor, choke the tight, double the danger, bait the night, catch me later, spit the knife, dirty the bather, follow the dark, aim your laser, make your mark,
date a stranger,
shook my heart,
date a stranger,
held my hand,
date a stranger,
made some plan,
date a stranger,
write a tear,
date a stranger,
disappear,
date a stranger,
I'm watching the door, forgetting who pour my eyes into the floor, I can't wait anymore, I don't know you now, I didn't know you before, I don't feel you now, your waves left my shore, I don't see you now, though your face I look for, I don't need you now, but I still watch the door.
That's 2020 new music from Emily Ritz with the song Door Watcher. Here's new music from Noveller from 2020. The song is called The Accident. Hi, I'm Jalal from the Victory Bus Project. You're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA.
I'm Ralph.
And I'm Bill.
We're the tech guys.
Not the car guys.
But if you love car talk and use a computer.
Or the internet.
Or Zoom.
And you have glitches, grief, hassles.
Or maybe you just have a stupid question.
We're the wise guys with answers.
Sometimes stupid answers, but...
Monday nights, 7 p.m. WGXC.
Tech Talk, 518-697-7400. Tech Talk.
Tune in.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable. All the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Seth Lane of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio, and I heard this thing.
90.7 FM, listener-aided and abetted radio.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Melanie Lekosubic is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Village elections in New York will take place September 15th, 6 months later than originally planned as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. In the only contested race in Columbia County, voters in the village of Kinderhook are being asked to choose from four candidates vying to fill two vacancies on the village board. Michael Abrams, Robert Bausmeister, Mark Brown, and Doreen Weir. Abrams is running on the old Kinderhook party line. He has lived in the county since May 2015 and is the founder of Four Block, a nonprofit organization that helps military veterans transition back to civilian life. He is a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, having served 8 years active duty. He continues to serve in the reserves. Abrams attended Tamarack High School in Troy, received his bachelor's degree from SUNY Cortland, and an MBA from New York University. If elected, he hopes to bring new businesses to Kinderhook, wants to protect the integrity of the village water supply, and to lead efforts to, and I quote, reach out to developers, business owners, and potential visitors, end quote, to promote Kinderhook for potential new business. Incumbent trustee Robert Baumeister has lived in Kinderhook for 46 years. He is a retired Verizon area manager. Baumeister is a Vietnam veteran who served in the U.S. Navy. His name will appear on the Bell Party line on the ballot. Baumeister's priorities, if reelected, including, and I quote, the new trail that will be opening up, the village will have to maintain it, end quote. He is also looking to complete plans for the new butterfly park. Other recreational sites are also on Baumeister's plans. He said, and I quote, the park on Rothermel Avenue, the tennis court has to be repaired again, and we have a lot of little rides for kids that have to be replaced, end quote. Candidate Mark Brown is running on the Shamrock Party line. He is a member of the Kinderhook Planning Board and chairman of the village's Comprehensive Plan Committee. Brown has been a resident of Kinderhook since 1996. He said, and I quote, I want to preserve the character of this rural historic community, support managed growth, and enable improvements to the services rendered, end quote. Brown is a past member of the Kinderhook Runners Club, a current member of the OK5K committee, race director for the Red Apple Run and Linden Walk Trail Run, and a member of the Northwest Columbia Trails. Candidate Doreen Weir has lived in Columbia County for 41 years. She's running on the Lindenwald party line. Weir is a graduate of Kevany Memorial Academy and the State University of New York at Albany. Rebuilding infrastructure is at the top of her list of concerns if she is elected. Weir said, and I quote, I believe that infrastructure is a top challenge for our village. If elected, I would assist in any way possible with aggressive and timely submission of the New York State Drinking Water Grant, along with written correspondence and personal interaction with our state senator, end quote. Maintaining a dialogue with constituents is key for Weir. The polls are open noon to 9 p.m. at Village Hall on Chatham Street, Tuesday, September 15th. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Michael Hallisey reports for Spotlight News that Albany County Executive Dan McCoy signed the county's Clean Air Act into effect September 10th. The law stops new waste facilities and two businesses on either end of the county from burning waste products. The Lafarge Holcomb Cement Plant in Ravenna had received a DEC permit to burn tires, and Norlite in Cohoes was already burning firefighter foam with the carcinogen PFOA and PFOS chemical compounds. Now that toxic smoke won't be allowed in the county. The Albany County Legislature passed the bill by a 32-7 vote last month, and you can read the full story at Spotlight News website. Emily Munson is reporting for the Times Union. The State Department of Labor announced September 10th more than 2 million New Yorkers will begin to receive a new $300 weekly federal unemployment benefit next week. Up to 2.4 million state residents are eligible for the program, but some must submit an additional certification to qualify. New York was approved to distribute the new benefit by the Federal Emergency Management Agency on August 23rd. The benefit will be paid in addition to regular state unemployment benefits. It is being provided under a federal executive order signed by President Donald Trump after the previous federal unemployment benefit of $600 per week expired in late July. The State Labor Department said FEMA released fundings for the first 3 weeks of benefits covering the weeks ending August 2nd, 9th, and 16th. The state may be eligible for additional weeks of benefits if funding for the program lasts. The unemployment rate in New York was 16% in July, compared to a national rate of 10.5%, according to the state. Congress has failed to strike a deal on the extension of the federal unemployment program, among several other disagreements over continued coronavirus relief. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. Kyle Jaeger is reporting for MarijuanaMoment.com. A report from the New York State Association of Counties, or NYSAC, includes marijuana legislation among the proposals made by the coalition this week as a way to offset economic losses caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The report includes a brief section stating that adult use cannabis legalization, and I quote, will provide the state and counties with resources for public health education and technical assistance. Counties should be allowed to apply their local sales tax rate on these transactions, end quote. It states, and I quote, in addition, the cannabis cultivation tax should be shared with the county in which the product is grown, end quote. In all, the more than 80 proposed policy changes put forward by the association were submitted to the State Division of Budget in the interest of building local economy statewide. Dan McCoy, the Albany County executive, said that the report sends a message to state officials that, and I quote, we're ready, willing, and able to be constructive partners in the economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, end quote. Governor Andrew Cuomo pushed for legalization as part of his last two budget proposals, but lawmakers have yet to reach consensus on the issue. The state Senate has approved several modest marijuana reform bills in recent months. And you can read the full story at MarijuanaMoment.com. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes?
Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu, up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
Trump's rushed, racist vaccine strategy seeks votes, not a cure. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Humanity, confronting the worst pandemic in a century, should be engaged in an unprecedented race for a cure. Under the World Health Organization, vaccine development is proceeding through a vast global collaboration. Noticeably absent, however, is the United States. Here, President Donald Trump is intent on releasing a vaccine before Election Day, placing his lust for power above the urgent demands of public health. Millions of Americans could be harmed if Trump forces the release of a vaccine before it's proven to be safe and effective. The coronavirus contagion disproportionately impacts African American, Latinx, and indigenous communities, exposing long-standing inequities and systemic racism in our healthcare system. Despite this, communities of color in the United States have been underrepresented in the clinical trials for prospective COVID-19 vaccines. Centuries of abusive treatment at the hands of medical researchers have left people of color rightly skeptical of the experimental process. Everyone wants a cure for COVID-19 and a return to a semblance of life as we knew it. But the path forward must be inclusive, ethical, and unambiguously free of Donald Trump's racism and political thuggery. The most notorious abuse of African Americans at the hands of the medical establishment was the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. In 1932, the U.S. Public Health Service recruited 400 African American men with syphilis, studying the disease's progression when purposefully left untreated. The subjects were given useless placebos and tracked over decades as their symptoms worsened, even though penicillin was identified as a reliable treatment in 1945. Syphilis can disfigure, cause dementia, blindness, extreme chronic pain, and death. Repeated concerns with the unethical study were ignored until a whistleblower's account of the experiment to the press 40 years later in 1972 shut it down.
It's important to understand that there was a scientific animus called scientific racism.
That's Harriet Washington, author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. She was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
It posited that black people were very, very different from whites, medically and biologically. And this provided a rationale and an underpinning not only for the institution of slavery. Slavery probably could not have persisted if there hadn't been this medical underpinning, but also for the use of blacks in research.
Harriet Washington describes the Tuskegee experiment and its historical antecedents, how enslaved African Americans, while enduring forced labor, violence, malnutrition, and exhaustion, were also subjected to medical experimentation. Enslaved women suffered painful gynecological experiments at the hands of Dr. J. Marion Sims, considered the father of gynecology. New York City finally removed a statue of Sims from Central Park in 2018. Following emancipation, African Americans were still forced into medical studies, often through coerced participation while imprisoned. Further mistrust of medical researchers was sown among many African Americans after it was revealed that a cell line used worldwide for research for decades, so-called HeLa cells, were actually taken from an African American cancer patient named Henrietta Lacks without her or her family's knowledge. African Americans are at least 2.4 times as likely as whites to die from COVID-19 and account for at least 21% of U.S. COVID deaths, but only 13% of the U.S. population. This according to the COVID Tracking Project. Latinx and Native American and Alaska Native people are 1.5 times as likely to die of the disease as are whites. A group of researchers wrote in a recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, as we strive to overcome the social and structural causes of health care disparities, we must recognize the underrepresentation of minority groups in COVID-19 clinical trials, unquote. President Trump has mishandled the federal response to the pandemic and has lied about it. Recorded conversations between journalist Bob Woodward and the president reveal Trump had been briefed on the severity of the pandemic as early as February 7th, but decided to downplay the crisis in public statements. Instead, he held re-election rally after rally around the country. He did not declare a national emergency until March 13th. Columbia University researchers reported in May that more than 80% of U.S. deaths and infections could have been prevented had social distancing and other control measures been implemented just 2 weeks earlier. Amidst an historic pandemic, A massive recession devastating working people while the wealth of the investor class surges, with unprecedented mass mobilizations against racism and police brutality, and a critical election less than 2 months away. The last thing we need is an aspiring autocrat like Donald Trump perverting the worldwide effort to create a COVID-19 vaccine. The research must be scientifically sound, transparent, and inclusive. And any vaccine thus developed must be distributed equitably around the world for free. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, sunny with a high near 71 degrees. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low of around 52. And on Sunday, showers are likely mainly after 5 p.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature high near 73 degrees. And more showers Sunday night, mainly before 8 p.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a low of around 60. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia Counties.
This is George Spencer. This is Art Etc. And I'm here in Hudson with Robert Palumbo at the Pamela Salisbury Gallery at 362 1/2 Warren Street. And Robert has a wonderful show of his photographs going back over a number of years, and they cover a number of subjects. And I think, as we'll find out as we talk a little bit, I think I'm correct, Robert, correct me if I'm not correct. I think sort of your main concern is humanity and what happens to people under stressful situations.
Absolutely, and thank you, George, for inviting me to talk about my work today. I'm very happy to talk to you and to present this work in Hudson. Yes, I think that it's fair to say that my main subject, my main concern, has always been humanity and the different ways in which human beings react to stressful situations, react to crisis, and really react to each other. That's really, to me, what's the most important thing about photography, but also about all art and also about life in general.
You know, I do these interviews because, you know, I'm interested in a lot of things, and I like meeting people, and I like finding out what they do. But generally, there's also sort of a technical question or a couple of technical questions that I have that have to do with things that interest me. And so I'm going to start out by asking you a question of that sort, because the work I do, I'm moving it into larger formats now, and it's an interesting process to me. So my question is this: when you start to photograph something, do you have in mind the size that it's going to be?
You know, I use a lot of different kinds of cameras when mm-hmm. I photograph. You know, everything from an iPhone up to, you know, a very high resolution digital camera. And usually, if I know something is going to be bigger, or I think I might make a big print of something, I'll try to shoot at a higher resolution. But it is actually pretty random, and it's often dependent upon how much I need to carry. And
need to carry in terms of physically
carry. Yeah, like I can carry around a large camera or a small camera. In fact, recently I've been shooting with a very small point-and-shoot Japanese camera called a Ricoh, which has very high resolution. Surprisingly, that camera can make very large prints, so it's kind of the best of both worlds for me. I can choose whether to post something on Instagram with that camera or to make a 24x36 print. The technology has gotten so much better that, you know, you really can gather your photographs and then decide what to do with them.
So when you're traveling and you have a bag, I guess, with the cameras, I mean, you have a lot of lenses?
Often I do. Often I will have a bag with a lot of lenses, sure. But there are some situations where you can't really carry a lot of lenses into a place. You know, for mm-hmm. instance, I've worked a lot under war conditions where you don't really want to be burdened with a big bag full of lenses, so really you just want one camera or two cameras with as minimal burden as you can possibly muster and still get what you need to get.
And I guess you've done this for so long, you sort of know in advance what you're going to need for what you expect to find.
Yeah, I think like most photographers, you know, I have a love affair with my gear. And there are certain elements of the gear, certain cameras, certain lenses that I really consider to have personality.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, where you grew up.
Okay, sure. I was actually born in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, which is about 50 miles north of Pittsburgh.
Do you know whether Pennsylvania is going to go Republican or Democrat?
You know, I can't tell you for sure which way it's going to go. I do know that my brother and sister are Republicans, and I'm trying to figure out a way to talk to them about the election and perhaps sway them. I have certain strategies, but I haven't tried that yet.
Good luck.
Yeah,
it's a tough sell.
No, it is a tough sell. So I grew up there. I grew up in a place that was basically a city that had a population of 75 or 80,000 during World War II, and by the time I was born in the 60s, the population had gone down to like 30,000. So the steel industry, which was the heart and soul of that area, was dying out. So I was born into industrial ruin. Hence, I've always been really, I think, attracted to the visuals of industrial ruin. You know, I love Hudson's, like Basilica Hudson and all the amazing, you know, old industry here, which I grew up with in Newcastle and in Pittsburgh. Eventually, I went to film school, for graduate school at Temple University in Philadelphia. So really, I was trained as a filmmaker and began making films there.
What got you into, attracted you to filming?
You know, I've always been really attracted to storytelling. When I was an undergraduate at University of Pittsburgh, I was a writer. I had amazing teachers there, including Toni Morrison.
Oh, really?
Yale Doctorow, I had a workshop with. So I was obsessed with storytelling and writing. But film to me, when I began to discover particularly European filmmakers and different ways of telling stories through filmmaking, I became attracted to and obsessed with the idea of making films. And so I went to graduate school for film. Photography was almost a sideshow to that. I mean, I learned how to be a cinematographer during that process, but still photography was something that I just kind of did on the side. I've never taken a class in still photography.
Oh, really?
Never studied it, really. I've studied it, you know, independently. I love certain photographers and I've studied them deeply, but I've never actually had a workshop in photography.
Well, what would you have learned if you had gone and spent 2 years
That's a really good question. I mean, of course, there's the technical side of photography, which I don't think is really that complicated, you know. But there's also the process, the creative process, and I feel like, you know, it's a question I ask myself a lot because I have taught classes in filmmaking in the past, and I really want to teach classes in still photography now, and I'm trying to wrap my head around what that means. Like, I don't want to tell you how to realize your vision. I don't want to somehow steer you in a way that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I want everyone to have their own independent vision. So right, studying photography or any creative art is kind of a mystery in a way. Like, how do you inspire creativity beyond the mere technical aspect?
Well, there seems to be sort of a tug of war between the people who want to tell you, okay, here's the conclusion, here's the answer, do this, and the people who want to open you up.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that's true. Yeah. Yeah, a crit, you know, in art school or in photography is very interesting. It's an interesting concept. You have a teacher basically critiquing your work. Now, I can understand a critique based on what your goals were in creating the work and whether or not you realized them. But the actual judgment process is something that is mysterious and you know, it's very complicated.
So you got out of film school, and then what happened?
Well, I got out of film school. I moved from Philadelphia to New York City.
In the 90s,
yeah. And I made a feature film when I was in Philadelphia, and I thought I would just keep making feature films, and I developed a couple of feature films after I came to New York, but realized that process did not really pay the bills, developing features, and, you know, I came close to getting another one off the ground a couple of times, but In the end, I gravitated more towards documentary filmmaking. Mm-hmm. At the time, documentary filmmaking was beginning to really come into its own on American television, and so I did that to make a living, and eventually worked a lot for National Geographic TV. They have a TV network that began in the late 90s, and I was sort of in on the beginnings of that. A dream come true for me, a dream that I didn't even know I had, really. A dream that brought me to Africa, to India, all over the world, with my video camera as a one-man band producer, but also with my still camera.
So you were actually sort of your own executive producer.
Essentially, yeah. I was the producer, director, field producer, cinematographer, all in one, sound person, all in one. The gear had become so small and manageable that you could do that. So I was a storyteller out there in the world, embedded with Doctors Without Borders, for instance, in Sudan and in Ethiopia, telling stories and meeting people, meeting amazing people all over the world. And that was sort of beginnings for me of the documentary filmmaking process, and the still photography went hand in hand with that.
Mm-hmm. So was that sort of a day job, and you were doing other things at the same time, or was it just so all-encompassing?
It was pretty much all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my life. I mean, it was my job. I had my own independent work sort of that was in tandem with that work. But that was what paid the bills. I was hired as a producer and director to film all over the world for National Geographic.
Mm-hmm. I think you said a little while ago that you spent a lot of time looking at the work of photographers. I'm wondering who those were.
Yeah. I love some of the classic American photographers like Robert Frank. I think Robert Frank's work is amazing. He was inspirational to me. I also really fell in love with the work of a more obscure British photographer named John Deacon, who was essentially a portrait and fashion photographer in England in the 50s. He was part of the group around Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon. He's taken some of the most famous portraits of Francis
Bacon. Did Freud do a painting of him?
I think Freud did a painting of him, yeah. I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did. I always liked his direct style. He was someone who used the mugshot as an artistic form, which I really fell in love with, at a certain point. Deacon has been inspirational to me. Robert Frank, Avedon, some of his earlier work, also the documentary work, been inspirational to me. But I've also been really into Japanese photographers. Daido Moriyama is one of my heroes, actually, who's a street photographer, a very raw style, but I really love what he does with his work, which is about combining images as much as it is about individual images.
When you say combining images, you're talking about collaging images?
It's books. I mean, really, his primary art form is books. Uh-huh. So he will take, thousands of his street photographs and combine them into a book, and the way that he lays them out, the way that he makes them into a story is really fascinating to me. It's really great.
You have a show here now, and that show, which you just took me on a tour of, is really an incredible show. And to me, what one of the main things is, it seems to me that there is no subterfuge in your work.